As our lesson came to close on Sunday, Jesus had made the point of walking in the light. It's part of the analogy of what he was making in the latter part of chapter 12, where he had already said a little previously in the text of the chapter about the need of walk in the light while you have the light. It's a lot harder to walk in darkness is what the point that he was coming to and leading to. Then in verse 46, he says, I have come as a light into the world, that whoever believes in me should not abide in darkness. It's a repeated point of some things that he has said before. But being repeated now, just in the hours, really, before he would be betrayed and led away for crucifixion. And as he was speaking most specifically here to his disciples and his apostles, he said to them in verse 47, if anyone hears my words and does not believe, I do not judge him, for I did not come to judge the world, but to save the world. He who rejects me and does not receive my words has that which judges him. The word that I have spoken will judge him in the last day. For I have not spoken on my own authority, but the Father who sent me gave me a command what I should say and what I should speak. And I know that his command is everlasting life. Therefore, whatever I speak, just as the Father said to me, so I speak. And he has said and he has confirmed again here to his disciples that he is not here on his own authority, but the Father had sent him. And everything that he has said has been by the will of the Father, the authority of the Father. And so as we go into chapter 13, Jesus teaches a lesson by illustration that is a very strong and a very powerful lesson. It was, he gives, as he has done before, he gives a life illustration here of what it means to be humble, what it means to serve, and really, part of the illustration, what comes out of the illustration is that Jesus is going to serve even those who do not deserve to be served. And there'll be some points of application I think we can make with that as we go along. But think about the scene here for just a moment. I mean, we have Jesus, the Son of God, who is with his closest associates. He's here with his apostles, and what he is going to do is wash their feet. And it might be a little bit hard for us just to fully get a picture in our mind of just what he's doing and what's going on and their reactions. I mean, I very much would just love to have been able to see the reactions of the apostles when Jesus was making preparation and getting things put in place to wash their feet. And what were they thinking? Because surely they were not imagining that it was Jesus who was going to be the one to wash their feet. But part of what comes out of this is the point that true greatness is not found in serving self, but true greatness is going to be found in serving others. And that's exactly what Jesus is going to do. And that's what he's trying to teach them. And he's going to demonstrate that not just in the washing their feet now, but in an incredibly grand way in just a few more hours. It's a little bit hard to determine exactly, you know, the timeline on the final days of Christ. But we're down to Thursday or Friday of the week now when this event takes place. And so that's why I keep saying the crucifixion is just right here. It's just ready to happen. And here we find the next five chapters in John's account, as we're looking at here, is just filled with instructions from Jesus to his apostles. I mean, he knows he's down to the last moments. And there's not any time wasted. You know, it's like sometimes when you have written a letter or an email to someone and you haven't talked to in a while and you're kind of getting done and say, oh yeah, one more thing. Let me tell you about one more thing. Or you've been visiting with family and here it is, it's time to leave. It's been a long time since you've seen them. It's going to be a long time until you see them again. And sometimes those, you know, departing is a little bit hard. And you keep thinking of, oh yeah, let me tell you about something else real quick. You keep thinking of something else to say. And it's a little bit reminiscent of that to me when I read the final chapters here in the book of John before Jesus is led off to be crucified. Jesus has spent 3.5 years with his closest disciples. And we know by going through all the gospel accounts, he had a lot to say to them and a lot to teach them. But as the days grow to an end, the hours are drawing near to the end, Jesus still has a lot of things to say. And he's still trying to cover those things. So when we look at chapter 13, we read the first few verses here. We see Jesus becoming the master servant. Verse 1. Now before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come, that he should depart out of this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. And supper being ended, the devil having already put it into his heart, or into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing all that the Father had given, or that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come from God and was going to God, rose from supper, laid aside his garments, took a towel, and girded himself. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. Then he came to Simon Peter, and Peter said to him, "Lord, are you washing my feet?" Jesus answered and said to him, "What I am doing you do not understand now, but you will know after this." And Peter said to him, "You shall never wash my feet." And Jesus answered him, "If I do not wash you, you have no part with me." And Simon Peter said to him, "Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head." Jesus said to him, "He who is bathed needs only to wash his feet, but is completely clean. And you are clean, but not all of you." For he knew who would betray him. Therefore he said, "You are not all clean." Well, let's spend a little bit of time just working our way through that text. It begins by telling us that it was the hour of Passover, that the feast of the Passover was at hand. Let's talk for just a moment about the feast of the Passover. Why was that significant? Why had so many come and gathered here? Describe the events of the feast of the Passover. What was going on? What do we know?
The feast and celebration of the Passover.
Okay. Yearly remembrance of these things. You know, it's brought back to their mind. This goes back to Exodus chapter 12. Remember the events that were happening then as Moses was preparing by the Lord's hand to lead the children of Israel out of Egypt. And the 10th plague was about to come upon Egypt here in the 12th chapter of Exodus. And so just reminding ourselves a little bit of this, what they were instructed was, in Exodus 12, verse 7, they are to take some blood and put it on the sides and the tops of the door frames of the houses where they eat the lambs. That same night they were to eat the meat roasted over the fire along with bitter herbs and bread made without yeast. Do not eat the meat raw or cooked in water, but roasted over the fire, head, legs, and inner parts. Do not leave any of it until morning. If some is left till morning, you must burn it. This is how you are to eat it, with your cloak tucked in your belt, your sandals on your feet, your staff in your hand. Eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. Verse 12. On that same night, I will pass through Egypt and strike down every firstborn, both men and animals. I will bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt. I am the Lord. The blood will be a sign for you on the houses where you are, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you. No destructive plague will touch you when I strike Egypt. Now, what the children of Israel would be told later was that they would remember this every year. And the fathers were to tell the children, year after year, remind them, here's the story, so that they would remember the Passover, when the Lord passed over them in Egypt. And so here we are hundreds of years later, the Passover is still being remembered. And there were hundreds or thousands of Jews who had come to Jerusalem, you know, to remember this. Jesus was there too. They were expecting Jesus to be there because he had come to all the other feasts. You know, as we've read through the book of John, they were expecting him to come. And as we've seen, the Jewish leaders are ready. They have their plan, you know, that they are going to put hands on the Lord. And so we just get in mind here the feast of the Passover and why everyone's there and what they're preparing to do. In verse 1 in our text, it said of Jesus that he loved them to the end. What does that comment have to do with the context? Why is that being said even at this point? What does it signify to us?
Well, I think it's related to what was said just immediately before that, regarding the fact that he knew his hour had come, that he should depart from this world and return to the Father.
That his time is at hand. You know, that his life is coming to an end.
It's also laying the groundwork for what he's about to do, washing their feet, and showing his love for them.
It's a little bit interesting to me to think about. Here he's been with these men for 3.5 years, or they've been with him. And he's had plenty of time to see all the good and the bad about them. He knows the faithful and the unfaithful. And yet he still loves them all. This is why he's about to do what he's going to do, his love for them and his love for us. But here they are about to eat the Passover feast. And try to imagine Jesus as they're preparing for this Passover feast, knowing what's going to come after that, and knowing that he's going to be sitting at the table with Judas. I mean, that might be a little bit hard for us to kind of get that picture in our mind, but that's a powerful picture to me, that he's going to sit at the same table with Judas, the one that's going to betray him. Now, he's not been revealed yet to everyone else, but the Lord knows. Because as indicated in the text we just read, that he knows that which one is going to betray him. You know, you would have to wonder how Jesus could focus on eating and focus on teaching his disciples, knowing that Judas was right there in front of him. Of course, then maybe on the other hand, maybe that's what helped Jesus to focus, because it made it so abundantly clear why he was there. And it brought to mind such a real way of what was about to take place in just a few hours. And so you can see, you know, different sides to that. Now, here's one of our questions. I hope you've thought about this some. You know, we're thinking about talking about Judas and what he's about to do. Was Judas forced to betray Jesus? You know, how do we answer that? Because, I mean, it's been foretold that there was one who was going to betray Jesus. And Jesus has known that all along and has spoken of it before. Did Judas have a choice in this? You know, was Judas forced to betray Jesus?
I used to really feel sorry for Judas because I thought he was in this situation where he had been foretold.
Maybe.
That still doesn't excuse it. But
no.
I.
So that's good. That's interesting. How would you respond? Everybody's saying, "Well, no. He wasn't. He didn't. He wasn't forced to do it." How do we explain that? Because some people are going to ask the question, you know, and are going to say, "Well, Judas had no choice in this matter."
Well, he'd already made arrangements.
Well, he's about to.
He sold him 30 pieces.
Sure did.
God understands the personality of people and what people are going to do.
Okay, good thoughts. What else? I saw your hand.
He yielded to his vulnerability, which was greed.
Yeah.
And he didn't prepare himself against it. He was right for the moment. He had that kind of heart.
Someone said it this way. He said, we are not responsible for the evil thought suggested by the devil, but we are responsible for harboring it and acting on it. You know, we are all responsible for what we do. You know, we are not responsible for the evil that Satan suggests. Satan's responsible for that. But when we hold on to the evil that Satan suggests, then it becomes ours.
God's foreknowledge about what Judas would do, and Judas's free will to make choices for right and wrong, are two completely independent things. God knew what Judas would do and put him in that position, in that place, but he didn't make Judas do it. Judas made decisions on his own free will.
Okay, good thoughts. In the book of Luke, you know, go ahead, Ken.
Bible references the justice of God. God can't be judged if he forces someone to violate his will and is accountable for violating his will.
Very true. Very true. The justice of God works in different ways. And it can work for us. I guess you could say it works against us too when we've worked against God. It's that same justice that'll judge against us. But it's that same justice that will judge for us when we live according to his will.
Judas himself didn't blame God.
Interesting
he
point.
He blamed himself.
That's right. That's right. He apparently would regret what he would do. In Luke's account, chapter 22, Luke chapter 22, verses 1 through 6. Here's the way Luke recorded some things. He said, now the feast of the unleavened bread drew near, which is called Passover. And the chief priests and the scribes sought how they might kill him, for they feared the people. Then Satan entered Judas, surnamed Iscariot, who was numbered among the 12. And he went his way and conferred with the chief priests and captains how he might betray him to them. And they were glad and agreed to give him money, and he promised and sought opportunity to betray him to them in the absence of the multitude. So there's a plan that's made now. Judas was a part of that plan. He was bought to be a part of that plan to betray the Lord. Now, the devil did not force Judas beyond his own will to betray God, but he tempted him, no doubt. As Elaine said, I mean, a weakness of Judas was greed, was money. We've seen that already in the text. You know, that Judas would take money out of the treasury, so to speak, that was used by the apostles and the Lord in the work that was being done. We already know that about Judas. And so there's an opportunity to betray the Lord, and there's money that's involved. Sure enough, that's a temptation to Judas. Earl had mentioned Sunday morning, we've talked about this before, with Pharaoh. We were talking about Pharaoh before, in the hardening of Pharaoh's heart. It's amazing that, you know, that the same word that comes from God to one person sinks in their heart and it brings about change of life. That same word comes to the heart of someone else and their heart becomes hardened and they reject God. And Earl mentioned, I love this phrase, you know, the same sun that melts wax hardens clay. I love that phrase. Because, you know, it's interesting. The source, the sun, it can melt wax, it can harden clay. It depends on the substance. And our heart is like that, too. The Word of God can soften our heart or it can harden our heart. And that's totally dependent on us, our heart, and what we do with that Word. And so when I got thinking about Judas a little bit, you know, with regard to this, because this is a question that sometimes people will bring up. It's like, you know, it seems like Judas here had no choice in the matter, that Judas was doomed from the beginning. Well, I don't believe that. I don't think so. That would take away all opportunity of free will. It would be saying that Judas was condemned to hell without any response from him. And there's just nothing in Scripture that leads us to that kind of conclusion with anybody. And so there's some other passages that kind of come to mind with this, like James chapter 1. I'll be turning over to James chapter 1. Troy?
Believing in Judas, he demonstrates his free will in Matthew 27 when he has remorse and brings money back.
Good point. Absolutely. Good point. I mean, there was the regret that overcame Judas. And we see that free will again. I mean, it'd be hard for me to imagine that Satan had anything to do with that regret. You know, that was the free will of Judas when he saw now what happened, that maybe this went in a direction he wasn't expecting it to go. It doesn't matter if he expected it to go that direction or not. You know, he was still part of an evil plot. It was greed that pulled him in. This is true too.
I mean, he did what Father told him.
That's right. Even though
he was tempted.
Yeah, multiple times. And even as the days are coming closer to an end, the Lord still had a choice. Even in the last chapter, we saw that there was a part of Jesus that was, he was not looking forward to the cross. I mean, that there was no joy to be found in the cross as far as the physical man goes. Remember, we were talking about the humanity of Jesus. And the divine side of Jesus. The humanity side of Jesus was not looking forward to the cross. He was dreading the cross. But he went forward to the cross because he knew of what that provided for man. In James chapter 1. James chapter 1, beginning verse 13. Begin verse 12, actually. The text says, "Blessed is the man who endures temptation. For when he has been proved, he will receive the crown of life which the Lord has promised to those who love him. Let no one say when he is tempted, 'I am tempted by God.' For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Then when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death." James says that in such a simplistic way, I get it. I've always appreciated the way James has said that, and helps in my mind to define where the problem of sin really comes from. When it pertains to each of us individually, when it's harbored in our heart, it's not that God is trying to tempt us and bring us down. That's not the position of God. He's doing everything and trying to put everything in place to pull us and lift us up. Now, Satan is wanting to bring us down. Chapter 4, James chapter 4. And verse 7, "Therefore submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you." Again, it's just that reminder that when we make a choice to resist Satan, when we make a choice to live for the Lord, Satan cannot endure that. You know, whatever Satan has to work against us is not more powerful than what the Lord has to pull us to him. It comes back to the choice that each of us might make. Some other thoughts, sir?
I find that I'm not really disturbed about the fact that some people are going to say, "Well, look, he forced him to do this," because this is the same intellect that would say, "Now I have been saved, and God has forced me to be saved now because he won't let me go."
That's right.
I can't betray him.
You know what? And that's a good point. Because there are those who would actually say that. You know, that they have been predestined to be saved. There's nothing that they've had to do with their salvation. And that God has predisposed them in that way. And from a biblical standpoint, there's nothing that justifies, you know, such a conclusion as that. You're right. You can see two sides.
In regards to destiny, as far as I can tell, Judas sealed his own destiny by not repenting and hanging. All the apostles denied Christ. Mm-hmm. And we think of Peter in particular, mm-hmm. you know, because he was sort of pointed out
right.
by Jesus and, you know, and said, prophesied that he would.
Right.
But they all denied him. And maybe, you know, the Lord knew what was going to happen, but was mm-hmm. it not possible that Judas could have repented?
Mm-hmm.
He certainly showed remorse when he
right.
threw the 30 pieces of silver back, you know, and
right.
the chief priest. But he sealed his destiny when he killed himself.
Yeah, yeah. I'm glad you brought this up, and that thought has slipped my mind, the fact that when we think about, denying the Lord, Judas was not in the minority on that. All the disciples went running away. And in fact, we're about to see that as we get into the story here, when Judas and the others come, after the Lord, ultimately all of the disciples are going to run away. So it's not just Judas that's there alone. So we're just trying to get a picture of all this in our mind, as the story is kind of unfolding to us this way. And maybe even it's important for us just to be reminded that, Satan's going to work on us the same way. Maybe it's not greed that would bring us to the point where Judas went. But it's something else. And sometimes we just have to be reminded that whatever it is that Satan is going to use against us is going to be whatever our greatest weakness is. But whatever our greatest weakness is, no matter how powerful Satan is, God is still trying to help us win. He's still trying to help us stand for what is right. Remember what Paul said, 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 13. You remember this. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 12, actually start. He says, "Therefore let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall." And so we're reminded that there's not one of us that can be so strong that we could never fall. None of us are that good. And so it's the reminder, let him who thinks he stands take heed. And then verse 13, "No temptation has overtaken you such as is common to man, but God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will also make a way of escape that you may be able to bear it." God understands our weaknesses and knows our temptations and is going to seek a way for us to have an escape. Judas had a means of escape. He did. Scripture says so. But he chose to follow the way of Satan.
There's a scripture somewhere in the Bible that says no man will ever be condemned to hell more than Judas. People should pity him. I don't know where.
Yeah, I don't know what that.
It may have been from a prophet. It just hangs in my memory.
I don't know of a scripture just like that. No, I don't know. Well, indeed, God will. And there was remorse on the part of Judas. He saw now what had happened. And maybe things didn't play out the way he thought they would play out. I don't know. We can't read into the mind of Judas. And he showed remorse. To take his own life was still the wrong way. And how God will deal with that and judge that, I don't know. I can't answer that. But that was the wrong answer in the end. For him to kill himself. But that's all the events that we're seeing that's unfolding or about to unfold. And so it's with Judas and with the 11, the other apostles, that the Lord has set down here for this Passover feast. And it's with Judas, as well as the 11, that he is going to get up and wash their feet. Now, there has to be the rest of the story, so to speak, with this. To understand why Jesus is washing their feet and what is the purpose of this. Was their feet dirty? Perhaps so. Why wouldn't their feet be dirty?
To make them fully clean.
Fully clean. So what is the idea of fully clean here? Here's something else that we have to look at. When Jesus said, when he ended up in our text by saying that you are not all clean, What is the point of that? But we're getting ahead. But be thinking about that for a moment. Because now just picture in your mind when Jesus gets up and he starts preparing himself, he gets the basin, he has the water, he has everything ready. And I can almost imagine the apostles thinking that, He's going to ask one of us to wash everyone's feet. Or is he going to ask me to wash the feet? Now, who would generally wash the feet of visitors when they came?
Slaves.
Perhaps the servants or the slaves. If you had servants or slaves, they would likely be the ones to wash. Why? Why is that? What would you say?
That's a very humbling thing, and the host is not apt to take himself down to that humble level with his guests.
The lowliest among them is who would likely be asked to do the washing of feet. So we're getting the humility part here, that there's something connected with that here. And, you know, this account in John 13 is kind of interesting. The other gospel accounts don't say anything about it. John has included it. And it becomes a very powerful lesson in many ways. It's a very powerful picture lesson. It's powerful to see the response of the disciples here. You know, Peter said, Lord, are you washing my feet? Imagine when the moment came when Peter and the apostles realized that actually Jesus is the one who's going to do this. I can only imagine at first that they were thinking that he was just making preparation and was going to ask somebody else to. No, no, Jesus is doing it. And Peter said, Lord, are you going to wash my feet? And so Peter couldn't understand why Jesus would be performing, you know, the duty of a servant. And yet the whole purpose of Jesus has been one of service and servitude. That was his reason for coming, to seek and save the lost. And he's about to demonstrate that this is just a foretaste of what he's about to do in a few hours with regard of servitude. And it's the opportunity to teach his servants something about servitude. I don't know. It's hard for me to imagine that Peter would have been anxious to wash the feet of his comrades. You know, that wouldn't have been what he was thinking. And maybe all of the apostles were kind of wondering, who is going to do this? And were surprised when Jesus was the one that did that. You know, in our text, you know, as First Peter said, no, Lord, you're not going to wash my feet. And Jesus said, well, you know, if I don't wash your feet, then I have nothing to do with you, and you have nothing to do with me. And Peter said, Lord, you know, wash all of me. And in verse 10, Jesus said, he who is bathed needs only to wash his feet, but is completely clean. And you are clean, but not all of you. For he knew who would betray him. Therefore he said, you are not all clean. What is he talking about here in these verses? He says, you are clean, but not all of you are clean. Does he mean that you're clean except for your feet? You know, is it about why their feet are dirty? What's he talking about here?
I think he's still trying to teach them the spiritual side of it. And he's talking about spiritually clean and clean of the mind.
Okay. There's several applications we might be able to start drawing and putting into this. Because Jesus is making a physical example, but there's a spiritual lesson that has to come out of this. But to understand this too, we have to keep in mind what was taking place in the big picture here. What was happening in Jerusalem? The Passover. The Passover is what was happening. What would the Jews do when they came to Jerusalem? When you think about all of the feasts that would take place and the need to be cleaned or purified, what would the Jews do? Now, here's something we have probably not thought about just a whole lot, but when you read through the Old Testament, you'll see that there are times that we will read about the need of being ceremonially clean. What are they talking about? What is that?
Yeah.
sometimes that's used as an example. I mean, that you can you could be cleaned ceremonially. You could be cleaned on the outside, but the inside, there's still a problem. Jesus certainly talked about that with the Pharisees in Matthew 23. Well, how did they become ceremonially clean?
Sacrifices.
Well, before they could sacrifice, though, they had to be clean.
Various washings.
The washing. Well, what about the washing? You know, how often have we talked about this? I mean, we really don't talk about this kind of thing, but sometimes when we're studying through the Old Testament, there's some occasion where we think, okay, so they had to wash themselves. The priests had some ways that they had to wash themselves. But when the Jews came to Jerusalem for the feasts, they had to become ceremonially clean. How did they do that? And here we have thousands of Jews that have come to Jerusalem. How do they become clean? Ceremonially clean. And it really doesn't have anything to do with Jesus washing their feet. When he's talking here about he who is bathed needs only to wash his feet, but is completely clean, and you are clean, but not all of you, I'm taking it that they have already become ceremonially clean. Okay, their feet might need washed again because they've become dirty, but ceremonially they are clean. Let's think about this. Oh, don't tell me that bell. I am not ready for that. Well, it's going to be a quick 5 minutes here. You know, think about the ceremonial cleansing for the Passover for a minute. And how was this done and how was this, you know, accomplished? You know, in the text, Jesus spoke about a figurative ceremonial cleaning, I think is what he's talking about here. And I would think evidently here they're eating the Passover. These Jewish men, these apostles, they have all become ceremonially clean. They have all washed themselves. I'm sure their clothes are clean and all of those things before they ate the Passover. But where did ceremonial cleansings take place? And how did thousands of Jews coming to Jerusalem all become ceremonially clean? Well, there had to be some place for that to happen or to take place. We've looked at this picture before, this model of Jerusalem. I just want you to kind of get your bearings straight here just a little bit, you know, to look at the temple. Here would be the old city of David on the south side of the city, the Kidron Valley. Over here would have been the Mount of Olives. We're kind of getting our bearings straight on that. A little bit closer look at the Temple Mount area, part of the city of David. Here are the stairs going up to the double gate. You know, these stairs, at least part of them, are still in place today, which is just really interesting. Another time, you know, we talk about that some. But this being the south wall of the city of Jerusalem, this would be the west wall. There's Wilson's Arch, as it's been called, right here. It doesn't stand today, but you can see the remnants of it. We're just getting our bearings straight. And so if we look here, now we're standing at the southwest corner right here of the city of Jerusalem, old city. That's the south wall, that's the west wall. And we're looking out over this. Over here would be the Mount of Olives back over on that side. Just getting our bearings straight. You have to wonder, well, I wonder, you know, what's down there by that wall? Let's back up here a little bit more, just another point, side point. That dome right there, that's part here of the Temple Mount. That's actually right there. That's a mosque. And that mosque and that, you know, the Temple Mount in Jerusalem represents, you know, the third most holy place in the religion of Islam, you know, behind Mecca and Medina. And so that's why there are so many Muslims that make their pilgrimage to Jerusalem every year, you know, to come there to the Temple Mount. It has nothing to do with our story, but when you see that in the picture, you have to think about that. And so we're just thinking here, trying to get our bearings around the old city of Jerusalem. We're still trying to understand how did all these Jews coming into Jerusalem, how did they become ceremonially clean if they all had to be cleansed? And still, you know, this is the southern wall. This will be the western wall here. This would be where the Jews stand in front of the wall and do their prayers, as we've seen before right there. But right down there below that wall, on that western wall, this is part of the old floor that's been, you know, dug up on the outside of the wall. I wonder, like, what's right over here? Like if you come down and walk through these little pillars and come over there, you walk through this and you walk to the other side of it, you look back over here at the western wall, here's the remnants of that Wilson Arch. Remember that archway? Here's the remnants of it right there. And you turn around behind where we're standing right now and look. Here's a ceremonial pool right here. It is said that there's over 100 of these in and around Jerusalem. These ceremonial pools where the Jews would have come and these would have been used for their ceremonial cleansings. You know, little pools like this all around the sea. This is in the inside looking out. That's Wilson Arch right there. We're looking at that western wall of the city of Jerusalem, or at least a portion of it. And on the south side of the Temple Mount, we're down by the double gate. When we're looking at those stairs there by the double gate of Jerusalem, right down there, we walked right by, you know, another pool. There these little pools like this all around Jerusalem. And here's some more just on the southern side of the old city of Jerusalem. And here's a couple others just around Jerusalem like this right here, all around. And so how did all those Jews become ceremonially cleansed, you know, before eating the Passover or partaking in part of the other feast or offering their sacrifices? They had to be cleansed before they offered their sacrifices. They had these pools all over the city where this could be done. How were 3,000 baptized in one day around the city of Jerusalem? Where do you suppose that took place? There were all of these pools all around Jerusalem. I imagine they were not being used for ceremonial cleansing, but there was a lot of cleansing that took place on the day of Pentecost in those pools all around the city of Jerusalem. And so when Jesus said, "He who is bathed needs only to wash his feet," I imagine as he's speaking to them, they've all been ceremonial cleansed. They've all been to these areas for cleansing. But Jesus, of course, is referring to something a little bit more than that. You know, in the bigger part of the context, for you are not all clean. There was one of them that no matter how they became clean physically, his heart wasn't right. And he didn't stand right before God because of the problem with his heart, speaking of Judas. Because that's the context of what we're talking about. So, a few things there to think about, you know, before the Lord's Day. And we'll try to work through the rest of chapter 13 on the Lord's Day. And maybe you'll have some questions about this by then. Thanks for your comments tonight.